Book 3. The Road to War. Chapter 9. The First Steps, 1934-1937. To talk peace, to prepare secretly for war, and to proceed with enough caution in foreign policy and clandestine rearmament to avoid any preventive military action against Germany by the Versailles powers. Such were Hitler's tactics during the first 2 years. He stumbled badly with the Nazi murder of the Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss in Vienna on July 25, 1934. At noon on that day, 154 members of the SS Standarte 89, dressed in Austrian army uniforms, broke into the Federal Chancellery and shot Dollfuss in the throat at a range of 2 feet. A few blocks away, other Nazis seized the radio station and broadcast the news that Dollfuss had resigned. Hitler received the tidings while listening to a performance of Das Rheingold at the annual Wagner Festival at Bayreuth. They greatly excited him. Friedelin Wagner, granddaughter of the great composer, who sat in the family box nearby, was a witness. Two adjutants, Schaub and Bruckner, she later told, kept receiving the news from Vienna on a telephone in the anteroom of her box and then whispering it to Hitler. After the performance, the Führer was most excited. This excitement mounted as he told us the horrible news. Although he could scarcely wipe the delight from his face, Hitler carefully ordered dinner in the restaurant as usual. "I must go across for an hour and show myself," he said, "or people will think I had something to do with this." They would not have been far from right. In the first paragraph of Mein Kampf, it will be remembered, Hitler had written that the reunion of Austria and Germany was a task to be furthered with every means our lives long. Soon after becoming chancellor, he had appointed a Reichstag deputy, Theodor Habicht, as inspector of the Austrian Nazi Party. And a little later he had set up Alfred Frauenfeld, the self-exiled Austrian party leader, in Munich, whence he broadcast nightly, inciting his comrades in Vienna to murder Dollfuss. For months prior to July 1934, the Austrian Nazis, with weapons and dynamite furnished by Germany, had instituted a reign of terror, blowing up railways, power stations, and government buildings, and murdering supporters of the Dollfuss clerical fascist regime. Finally, Hitler had approved the formation of an Austrian legion, several thousand strong, which camped along the Austrian border in Bavaria, ready to cross over and occupy the country at an opportune moment. Dollfuss died of his wounds at about 6 p.m., but the Nazi putsch, due largely to the bungling of the conspirators who had seized the chancellery, failed. Government forces, led by Dr. Kurt von Schuschnigg, quickly regained control, and the rebels, though promised safe conduct to Germany through the intervention of the German minister, were arrested, and 13 of them later hanged. In the meantime, Mussolini, to whom Hitler only a month before at their meeting in Venice had promised to leave Austria alone, caused uneasiness in Berlin by hastily mobilizing 4 divisions on the Brenner Pass. Hitler quickly backed down. The news story prepared for the press by the official German news agency, DNB, rejoicing at the fall of Dollfuss and proclaiming the greater Germany that must inevitably follow, was hastily withdrawn at midnight, and a new version substituted, expressing regret at the cruel murder, and declaring that it was a purely Austrian affair. Habicht was removed, the German minister in Vienna recalled and dismissed, and Papen, who had narrowly escaped Dollfuss's fate just a month before during the Röhm purge, was packed off to Vienna post-haste to restore, as Hitler directed him, normal and friendly relations. Hitler's first joyous excitement had given way to fear. "We are faced with a new Sarajevo," Papen says he shouted at him when the two conferred about how to overcome the crisis. But the Führer had learned a lesson. The Nazi putsch in Vienna, like the beer hall putsch in Munich in 1923, had been premature. Germany was not yet militarily strong enough to back up such a venture by force. It was too isolated diplomatically. Even fascist Italy had joined Britain and France in insisting on Austria's continued independence. Moreover, the Soviet Union was showing interest for the first time in joining the West in an Eastern Locarno, which would discourage any moves of Germany in the East. In the autumn, it joined the League of Nations. The prospects for dividing the great powers seemed dimmer than ever throughout the crucial year of 1934. All that Hitler could do was to preach peace, get along with his secret rearmament, and wait and watch for opportunities. Besides the Reichstag, Hitler had another means of communicating his peace propaganda to the outside world. The foreign press, whose correspondents, editors, and publishers were constantly seeking interviews with him. There was Ward Price, the monocled Englishman, and his newspaper, the London Daily Mail, who were always ready at the drop of a hint to accommodate the German dictator. So in August 1934, in another one of the series of interviews which would continue up to the eve of the war, Hitler told Price and his readers that war will not come again, that Germany had a more profound impression than any other of the evil that war causes, that Germany's problems cannot be settled by war. In the fall, he repeated these glowing sentiments to Jean Guy, a French war veterans leader and a member of the Chamber of Deputies, who passed them on in an article in the Paris daily Le Matin. The Breaching of Versailles. In the meantime, Hitler pursued with unflagging energy his program of building up the armed services and procuring arms for them. The army was ordered to treble its numerical strength, from 100,000 to 300,000 by October 1, 1934, and in April of that year, General Ludwig Beck, chief of the General Staff, was given to understand that by April 1 of the following year, the Führer would openly decree conscription and publicly repudiate the military restrictions of the Versailles Treaty. Until then, the utmost secrecy must be observed. Goebbels was admonished never to allow the words General Staff to appear in the press, since Versailles forbade the very existence of this organization. The annual official rank list of the German army ceased to be published after 1932, so that its swollen lists of officers would not give the game away to foreign intelligence. General Keitel, chairman of the Working Committee of the Reich Defense Council, admonished his aides as early as May 22, 1933, "No document must be lost, since otherwise enemy propaganda will make use of it. Matters communicated orally cannot be proven. They can be denied." The Navy, too, was warned to keep its mouth shut. In June 1934, Raeder had a long conversation with Hitler and noted down, "Führer's instructions, no mention must be made of a displacement of 25,000 to 26,000 tons, but only of improved 10,000-ton ships. The Führer demands complete secrecy on the construction of the U-boats." For the Navy had commenced the construction of two battle cruisers of 26,000 tons, 16,000 tons above the Versailles limit, which would eventually be known as the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau. Submarines, the building of which Versailles had prohibited, had been secretly constructed in Finland, Holland, and Spain during the German Republic, and recently Raeder had stored the frames and parts of a dozen of them at Kiel. When he saw Hitler in November 1934, he asked permission to assemble six of them by the time of the critical situation in the first quarter of 1935. Obviously, he too knew what Hitler planned to do at that time. But the Führer merely replied that he would tell me when the situation demanded that the assembly should commence. At this meeting, Raeder also pointed out that the new shipbuilding program, not to mention the tripling of naval personnel, would take more money than he had available, but Hitler told him not to worry. "In case of need, he will get Dr. Lai to put 120 to 150 million from the labor front at the disposal of the Navy, as the money would still benefit the workers." Thus, the dues of the German workers were to finance the naval program. Goering, too, was busy those first 2 years establishing the Air Force. As Minister of Aviation, supposedly civil aviation, he put the manufacturers to work designing warplanes. Training of military pilots began immediately under the convenient camouflage of the League for Air Sports. A visitor to the Ruhr and Rhineland industrial areas in those days might have been struck by the intense activity of the armament works, especially those of Krupp, chief German gunmakers for three-quarters of a century, and IG Farben, the great chemical trust. Although Krupp had been forbidden by the Allies to continue in the armament business after 1919, the company had really not been idle. As Krupp would boast in 1942, when the German armies occupied most of Europe, "The basic principle of armament and turret design for tanks had already been worked out in 1926. Of the guns being used in 1939 to 41, the most important ones were already fully complete in 1933. Farben scientists had saved Germany from early disaster in the First World War by the invention of a process to make synthetic nitrates from air after the country's normal supply of nitrates from Chile was cut off by the British blockade. Now, under Hitler, the Trust set out to make Germany self-sufficient in two materials without which modern war could not be fought: gasoline and rubber, both of which had had to be imported. The problem of making synthetic gasoline from coal had actually been solved by the company's scientists in the mid-20s. After 1933, the Nazi government gave IG Farben the go-ahead with orders to raise its synthetic oil production to 300,000 tons a year by 1937. By that time, the company had also discovered how to make synthetic rubber from coal and other products of which Germany had a sufficiency, and the first of four plants was set up at Schkopau for large-scale production of Buna, as the artificial rubber became known. By the beginning of 1934, plans were approved by the Working Committee of the Reich Defense Council for the mobilization of some 240,000 plants for war orders. By the end of that year, rearmament in all its phases had become so massive it was obvious that it could no longer be concealed from the suspicious and uneasy powers of Versailles. These powers, led by Great Britain, had been flirting with the idea of recognizing a fait accompli, that is, German rearmament, which was not nearly so secret as Hitler supposed. They would concede Hitler complete arms equality in return for Germany's joining in a general European settlement, which would include an Eastern Locarno, and thus provide the Eastern countries, especially Russia, Poland, and Czechoslovakia, with the same security which the Western nations enjoyed under the Locarno Treaty, and, of course, furnish Germany with the same guarantees of security. In May of 1934, Sir John Simon, the British Foreign Secretary, who was to be a good forerunner of Neville Chamberlain in his inability to comprehend the mind of Adolf Hitler, actually proposed equality of armaments to Germany. The French sharply rejected such an idea. But the proposals for a general settlement, including equality of armaments and an Eastern Locarno, were renewed jointly by the British and French governments early in February 1935. The month before, on January 13th, the inhabitants of the Saar had voted overwhelmingly, 477,000 to 48,000, to return their little coal-rich territory to the Reich. And Hitler had taken the occasion to publicly proclaim that Germany had no further territorial claims on France, which meant the abandoning of German claims on Alsace and Lorraine. In the atmosphere of optimism and goodwill which the peaceful return of the Tsar and Hitler's remarks engendered, the Anglo-French proposals were formally presented to Hitler at the beginning of February 1935. Hitler's reply of February 14th was somewhat vague, and, from his viewpoint, understandably so. He welcomed a plan which would leave Germany free to rearm in the open, but he was evasive on Germany's willingness to sign an Eastern Locarno. That would be tying his hands in the main area where, as he had always preached, Germany's Lebensraum lay. Might not Britain be detached in this matter from France, which, with its mutual assistance pacts with Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Romania, was more interested in Eastern security? Hitler must have thought so, for in his cautious reply he suggested that bilateral discussions precede general talks, and invited the British to come to Berlin for preliminary discussions. Sir John Simon readily agreed, and a meeting was arranged for March 6th in Berlin. 2 days before that date, the publication of a British white paper caused a great deal of simulated anger in the Wilhelmstrasse. Actually, the white paper struck most foreign observers in Berlin as a sober observation on Germany's clandestine rearmament, the acceleration of which had moved Britain to a modest increase of her own. But Hitler was reported furious with it. Neurath informed Simon on the very eve of his departure for Berlin that the Führer had a cold, and the talks would have to be postponed. Whether he had a cold or not, Hitler certainly had a brainstorm. It would be embarrassing to have Simon and Eden around if he transformed it into a bold act. He thought he had found a pretext for dealing the Versailles Diktat a mortal blow. The French government had just introduced a bill extending military service from 18 months to 2 years because of the shortage of youth born during the First World War. On March 10th, Hitler sent up a trial balloon to test the mettle of the Allies. The accommodating Ward Price was called in and given an interview with Goering, who told him officially what all the world knew, that Germany had a military air force. Hitler confidently awaited the reaction in London to this unilateral abrogation of Versailles. It was just what he expected. Sir John Simon told the Commons that he still counted on going to Berlin. A Saturday Surprise. On Saturday, March 16th, most of Hitler's surprises were reserved for Saturdays, the Chancellor decreed a law establishing universal military service and providing for a peacetime army of 12 corps and 36 divisions, roughly 500,000 men. That was the end of the military restrictions of Versailles, unless France and Britain took action. As Hitler had expected, they protested, but they did not act. Indeed, the British government hastened to ask whether Hitler would still receive its foreign secretary, a query which the dictator graciously answered in the affirmative. Sunday, March 17th, was a day of rejoicing and celebration in Germany. The shackles of Versailles, symbol of Germany's defeat and humiliation, had been torn off. No matter how much a German might dislike Hitler and his gangster rule, he had to admit that the Führer had accomplished what no Republican government had ever dared attempt. To most Germans, the nation's honor had been restored. That Sunday was also Heroes' Memorial Day, Heldengedenktag. I went to the ceremony at noon at the State Opera House and there witnessed a scene which Germany had not seen since 1914. The entire lower floor was a sea of military uniforms, the faded gray uniforms and spiked helmets of the old Imperial Army mingling with the attire of the new army, including the sky-blue uniforms of the Luftwaffe, which few had seen before. At Hitler's side was Field Marshal von Mackensen, the last surviving Field Marshal of the Kaiser's army, colorfully attired in the uniform of the Death's Head Hussars. Strong lights played on the stage, where young officers stood like marble statues holding upright the nation's war flags. Behind them, on an enormous curtain, hung an immense silver and black iron cross. Ostensibly, this was a ceremony to honor Germany's war dead. It turned out to be a jubilant celebration of the death of Versailles and the rebirth of the conscript German army. The generals, one could see by their faces, were immensely pleased. Like everyone else, they had been taken by surprise, for Hitler, who had spent the previous days at his mountain retreat at Berchtesgaden, had not bothered to apprise them of his thoughts. According to General von Manstein's later testimony at Nuremberg, he and his commanding officer of Wehrkreis III, the third military district in Berlin, General von Witzleben, first heard of Hitler's decision over the radio on March 16th. The general staff would have preferred a smaller army to begin with. The general staff, had it been asked, Manstein testified, would have proposed 21 divisions. The figure of 36 divisions was due to a spontaneous decision of Hitler. There now took place a series of empty gestures of warning to Hitler by the other powers. The British, the French, and the Italians met at Stresa on April 11th, condemned Germany's action, and reiterated their support of Austria's independence and the Locarno Treaty. The Council of the League of Nations at Geneva also expressed its displeasure at Hitler's precipitate action, and duly appointed a committee to suggest steps which might impede him the next time. France, recognizing that Germany would never join in Eastern Locarno, hastily signed a pact of mutual assistance with Russia, and Moscow made a similar treaty with Czechoslovakia. In the headlines, this closing of ranks against Germany sounded somewhat ominous, and even impressed a number of men in the German Foreign Office and in the army. But apparently not Hitler. After all, he had gotten away with his gamble. Still, it would not do to rest on his laurels. It was time, he decided, to pull out the stops again on his love of peace, and to see whether the new unity of the powers arrayed against him might not be undermined and breached after all. On the evening of May 21st, he delivered another peace speech to the Reichstag, perhaps the most eloquent and certainly one of the cleverest and most misleading of his Reichstag orations this writer, who sat through most of them, ever heard him make. Earlier that day, Hitler had promulgated the secret Reich Defense Law, putting Dr. Schacht, as we have seen, in charge of war economy and thoroughly reorganizing the armed forces. The Reichswehr of Weimar days became the Wehrmacht, Hitler, as Führer and Chancellor, was Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, Wehrmacht, and Blomberg, the Minister of Defense, was designated as Minister of War, with the additional title of Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, the only general in Germany who ever held that rank. Each of the three services had its own Commander-in-Chief and its own general staff. The camouflage name of Truppenamt in the army was dropped for the real thing, and its head, General Beck, assumed the title of Chief of the General Staff. But this title did not denote what it did in the Kaiser's time, when the General Staff Chief was actually the Commander-in-Chief of the German Army under the Warlord. Hitler was in a relaxed mood and exuded a spirit not only of confidence, but, to the surprise of his listeners, of tolerance and conciliation. There was no resentment or defiance toward the nations which had condemned his scrapping of the military clauses of Versailles. Instead, there were assurances that all he wanted was peace and understanding based on justice for all. He rejected the very idea of war. It was senseless, it was useless, as well as a horror. The bloodshed on the European continent in the course of the last 300 years bears no proportion to the national result of the events. In the end, France has remained France, Germany, Germany, Poland, Poland, and Italy, Italy. What dynastic egotism, political passion, and patriotic blindness have attained in the way of apparently far-reaching political changes by shedding rivers of blood has, as regards national feeling, done no more than touched the skin of the nations. It has not substantially altered their fundamental characters. If these states had applied merely a fraction of their sacrifices to wiser purposes, the success would certainly have been greater and more permanent. Germany, Hitler proclaimed, had not the slightest thought of conquering other peoples. Our racial theory regards every war for the subjection and domination of an alien people as a proceeding which sooner or later changes and weakens the victor internally, and eventually brings about his defeat. As there is no longer any unoccupied space in Europe, every victory can at best result in a quantitative increase in the number of the inhabitants of a country. But if the nations attach so much importance to that, they can achieve it without tears in a simpler and more natural way, by a sound social policy, by increasing the readiness of a nation to have children. No, National Socialist Germany wants peace because of its fundamental convictions. And it wants peace also owing to the realization of the simple primitive fact that no war would be likely essentially to alter the distress in Europe. The principal effect of every war is to destroy the flower of the nation. Germany needs peace and desires peace. He kept hammering away at the point. At the end, he made 13 specific proposals for maintaining the peace, which seemed so admirable that they created a deep and favorable impression, not only in Germany, but in all of Europe. He prefaced them with a reminder. Germany has solemnly recognized and guaranteed France her frontiers as determined after the Tsar plebiscite. We thereby finally renounced all claims to Alsace-Lorraine, a land for which we have fought two great wars. Without taking the past into account, Germany has concluded a non-aggression pact with Poland. We shall adhere to it unconditionally. We recognize Poland as the home of a great and nationally conscious people. As for Austria, Germany neither intends nor wishes to interfere in the internal affairs of Austria, to annex Austria, or to conclude an Anschluss. Hitler's 13 points were quite comprehensive. Germany could not return to Geneva until the League divested itself of the Versailles Treaty. When that was done and full equality of all nations recognized, he implied, Germany would rejoin the League. Germany, however, would unconditionally respect the non-military clauses of the Versailles Treaty, including the territorial provisions. In particular, it will uphold and fulfill all obligations arising out of the Locarno Treaty. Hitler also pledged Germany to abide by the demilitarization of the Rhineland. Though willing at any time to participate in a system of collective security, Germany preferred bilateral agreements and was ready to conclude non-aggression pacts with its neighbor states. It was also prepared to agree to British and French proposals for supplementing the Locarno Treaty with an air accord. As for disarmament, Hitler was ready to go the limit. The German government is ready to agree to any limitation which leads to abolition of the heaviest arms, especially suited for aggression, such as the heaviest artillery and the heaviest tanks. Germany declares herself ready to agree to any limitation whatsoever of the caliber of artillery, battleships, cruisers, and torpedo boats. In like manner, the German government is ready to agree to the limitation of tonnage for submarines, or to their complete abolition. In this connection, Hitler held out a special bait for Great Britain. He was willing to limit the new German navy to 35% of the British naval forces. That, he added, would still leave the Germans 15% below the French in naval tonnage. To the objections raised abroad that this would be only the beginning of German demands, Hitler answered, "For Germany, this demand is final and abiding." A little after 10 in the evening, Hitler came to his peroration. "Whoever lights the torch of war in Europe can wish for nothing but chaos. We, however, live in the firm conviction that in our time will be fulfilled not the decline, but the renaissance of the West. That Germany may make an imperishable contribution to this great work is our proud hope and our unshakable belief." These were honeyed words of peace, reason, and conciliation. And in the Western democracies of Europe, where the people and their governments desperately yearned for the continuance of peace on any reasonable basis, on almost any basis, they were lapped up. The most influential newspaper in the British Isles, the Times of London, welcomed them with almost hysterical joy. The speech turns out to be reasonable, straightforward, and comprehensive. No one who reads it with an impartial mind can doubt that the points of policy laid down by Herr Hitler may fairly constitute the basis of a complete settlement with Germany. A free, equal, and strong Germany instead of the prostrate Germany upon whom peace was imposed 16 years ago. It is to be hoped that the speech will be taken everywhere as a sincere and well-considered utterance meaning precisely what it says. This great journal, one of the chief glories of English journalism, would play, like the Chamberlain government, a dubious role in the disastrous British appeasement of Hitler. But to this writer, at least, it had even less excuse than the government, for in its Berlin correspondent, Norman Ebbett, it had, until he was expelled on August 16, 1937, a source of information about Hitler's doings and purposes that was much more revealing than that provided by other foreign correspondents or foreign diplomats, including the British. Though much that he wrote for the Times from Berlin in those days was not published, as he often complained to this writer and as was later confirmed, the Times editors must have read all of his dispatches and have been in the position, therefore, of knowing what was really going on in Nazi Germany and how hollow Hitler's grandiose promises were. "I do my utmost, night after night, to keep out of the paper anything that might hurt their, German, susceptibilities," Geoffrey Dawson, the editor of the Times, wrote on May 23, 1937, to his Geneva correspondent, H.G. Daniels, who had preceded Ebbett in Berlin. "I can really think of nothing that has been printed now for many months past to which they could possibly take exception as unfair comment." John Evelyn Wrench, Geoffrey Dawson, and Our Times. The British government, no less than the Times, was ready and anxious to accept Hitler's proposals as sincere and well-considered, especially the one by which Germany would agree to a navy 35% the size of Britain's. Hitler had shrewdly thrown out a hint to Sir John Simon, when the British Foreign Secretary and Eden made their postponed visit to him at the end of March, that a naval agreement might easily be worked out between the two powers which would guarantee English superiority. Now, on May 21st, he had made a public and specific offer, a German fleet of only 35% of the tonnage of the British. And he had added in his speech some especially friendly words for England. "Germany," he had said, "has not the intention or the necessity or the means to participate in any new naval rivalry." An allusion which apparently was not lost on the English to the days before 1914, when Tirpitz, enthusiastically backed by Wilhelm II, was building up a high seas fleet to match England's. "The German government," continued Hitler, "recognizes the overpowering vital importance, and therewith the justification, of a dominating protection for the British Empire on the sea. The German government has the straightforward intention to find and maintain a relationship with the British people and state which will prevent for all time a repetition of the only struggle there has been between the two nations. Hitler had expressed similar sentiments in Mein Kampf, where he had stressed that one of the Kaiser's greatest mistakes had been his enmity toward England and his absurd attempt to rival the British in naval power. With incredible naivete and speed, the British government fell for Hitler's bait. Ribbentrop, who had now become Hitler's messenger boy for foreign errands, was invited to come to London in June for naval talks. Vain and tactless, he told the British that Hitler's offer was not subject to negotiation. They must take it or leave it. The British took it, without consulting their allies of the Stresa Front, France and Italy, which were also naval powers and much concerned over German rearmament and German flouting of the military clauses of Versailles, and without even informing the League of Nations, which was supposed to uphold the 1919 peace treaties, they proceeded, for what they thought was a private advantage, to wipe out the naval restrictions of Versailles. For it was obvious to the most simple mind in Berlin that by agreeing to Germany's building a navy a third as large as the British, the London government was giving Hitler free rein to build up a navy as fast as was physically possible, one that would tax the capacity of his shipyards and steel mills for at least 10 years. It was thus not a limitation on German rearmament, but an encouragement to expand it, in the naval arm, as rapidly as Germany could find the means to do so. To add insult to the injury already done France, the British government, in fulfillment of a promise to Hitler, refused to tell her closest ally what kind of ships and how many Great Britain had agreed that Germany should build. Except that the German submarine tonnage, the building of submarines in Germany was specifically forbidden by Versailles, would be 60% of Britain's, and if exceptional circumstances arose, might be 100%. Actually, the Anglo-German agreement authorized the Germans to build 5 battleships whose tonnage and armament would be greater than that of anything the British had afloat, though the official figures were faked to deceive London, 21 cruisers and 64 destroyers. Not all of them were built or completed by the outbreak of the war, but enough of them, with the U-boats, were ready to cause Britain disastrous losses in the first years of the Second War. Mussolini took due notice of the perfidy of Albion. Two could play at the game of appeasing Hitler. Moreover, England's cynical attitude of disregarding the Versailles Treaty encouraged him in the belief that London might not take too seriously the flouting of the covenant of the League of Nations. On October 3, 1935, in defiance of the covenant, his armies invaded the ancient mountain kingdom of Abyssinia. The League, led by Great Britain and supported half-heartedly by France, which saw that Germany was the greater danger in the long run, promptly voted sanctions. But they were only partial sanctions, timidly enforced. They did not prevent Mussolini from conquering Ethiopia, but they did destroy the friendship of fascist Italy with Britain and France, and bring an end to the Stresa Front against Nazi Germany. Who stood the most to gain from this chain of events but Adolf Hitler? On October 4th, the day after the Italian invasion began, I spent the day in the Wilhelmstrasse talking with a number of party and government officials. A diary note that evening summed up how quickly and well the Germans had sized up the situation. The Wilhelmstrasse is delighted. Either Mussolini will stumble and get himself so heavily involved in Africa that he will be greatly weakened in Europe, whereupon Hitler can seize Austria, hitherto protected by the Duce, or he will win, defying France and Britain, and thereupon be ripe for a tie-up with Hitler against the Western democracies. Either way, Hitler wins. This would soon be demonstrated.